Every Least Sparrow, Carolyn Walker, has come into the studio to talk to us. And it's such a moving story. And I learned so much reading it. For one thing, because it's a memoir.
Yes.
And you're talking about your daughter. And she has Rubenstein-Tabe syndrome. And I hadn't heard of it before. Tell us what that is.
When she was diagnosed, it was what they called clinical diagnosis, like they diagnosed based on the symptoms. There was no test. Now there's a test. But it's a conglomeration of features, facial features, jointless thumbs, and then various body problems, you know, knee problems. Some children have heart problems. She didn't, thank goodness. Some have spinal problems. And varying degrees of mental retardation. There are some children who are very profoundly disabled, and there are others lesser so. And my daughter sort of falls in the middle there.
When Jennifer was born and you first learned that something's not right, I think probably any parent facing a childbirth, that's got to be the main fear, that you're going to be dealing with a birth defect. How did you find the strength? What did you tap into?
My faith, I would say. I'm a Christian, and part of it was that. And part of it was just, you know, I was afraid when the doctor came in and told me there might be problems. But honestly, I took one look at her and fell in love, and that's the truth. And after that, and you do what you have to do. I wanted her to have the best quality life that she could have. And so I started on the parade of doctors to fix what could be fixed, and speech therapists and physical therapists and all that. I just did what I felt I had to do to give her a quality life.
The doctor didn't immediately know what you were facing, did he?
No.
How rare is it? Do you know?
Well, when she was born, there were 200 known cases in the world.
That's it.
Yeah. But now on Facebook, there's over 1,000 members, so I'm assuming that there's at least 1,000 cases. I think it's still considered pretty rare, but there are more known cases. At the time she was born, it was often misdiagnosed as Down syndrome. Yeah, it took us a good year or more to get the diagnosis.
And I'm kind of skipping ahead here towards the end of the book, but what causes it? You found this out only much later.
Yes, I only actually found it out maybe a year ago on Facebook. There's a, apparently it has to do, there's two types, which I didn't know. And it has to do with a protein, the Krebs binding protein. But beyond that, I couldn't tell you if it's a missing protein or, you know, something went wrong with a protein. It's, you know, I didn't think of it as hereditary, although if a child with a woman with Rubenstein-Tabe syndrome has a baby, she does have a, as I understand it, a 50% chance of having a child with a syndrome. So there's some kind of genetic link there. At this point in my life, it just doesn't matter to me what the cause is. It mattered very much when she was little.
Well, that was interesting because there were moments in your book, you know, a lot of it is about the struggles that both you and your daughter and your husband, the whole family,
right,
that you face. But there are these moments that you seem to look at your daughter and think, you know, I love her just the way she is. There's something about her happiness, her acceptance of life. She's a very exuberant personality that you like it just like that.
That's true.
Yeah.
That's true. It didn't take long. She's a delightful, wonderful person. And in many ways, you know, I hate to think of people good or bad, better or worse, but she's sort of an ideal in my mind of how people should be because she doesn't have any prejudices, none at all. She doesn't care what color you are, what gender you are, how old you are. None of that matters to her.
Yeah, she seems like a very loving spirit.
She's a very
too.
Loving person.
Yeah. So your background is medical.
I did work in a hospital as a clerk.
You were in the emergency department. So you saw a lot of people coming in and out. Did that change your perspective? Did it help having an inside view of how the medical world works?
I worked there probably three or four years before she was born, and I really learned it's the best education I ever got was in a hospital. When she was born, because I didn't know what was wrong, I had some access to medical books at the hospital. And I remember one of the nurses saying to me at the lunch break one time, "Are you reading another book?" But it was compelling. I mean, I had to know. I don't think working in the hospital necessarily scared me about what she had. I think it empowered me in a way because I had knowledge to go on, and I could speak to the, for example, the orthopedic surgeons about her bones because I had enough knowledge by then. It's amazing what you learn on a job like that.
And then you talk in your book about your relationship with, she is treated by many doctors, but Dr. O'Neill and you seem to have a special relationship. How important is that to have a trusting, close relationship with a doctor of your child?
Oh, I think it's very important. I think it's important no matter what kind of a doctor you're seeing, really.
True.
But he was a true saint in our life because he's just a delightful, loving, wonderful, giving person. He's wonderful. And I'm not the only person that feels that way. Everybody in the community feels that way for the most part. But he was so generous. I remember him coming to tell me at night, like 11 o'clock at night, that she had a problem. And I thought, what are you doing here at this hour? Where's your, you know? But he had been in the library for a long time trying to figure it out. And he used to stop by the house once in a while. He was a fabulous man. Everyone loves him.
And he seemed to love your daughter.
He loved, yes, I think so.
And it was interesting. There's a moment in the book where you go to your doctor to fill out paperwork because you need healthcare funds to take care of your daughter. And he doesn't want to use the word retardation when filling out the
right.
paperwork. And you kind of have to press him to the wall and say, I might not get the money I need if you don't directly identify this. And you express some of your views with that word. Can you talk about that?
Well, yes, I can. Like so many people, I find the word retard highly offensive and variations on the word, like some of the, you know, futard or whatever. People are using in this modern area. They're just sticking tard on the end of it. And,
mm-hmm.
and you know immediately what their reference is. But I did not have a problem with the word retarded. It's like a rose is a rose. However, in the current era, I have encountered parents who have a problem with that word. And they prefer the developmental disability, I think, which to me is a big mouthful. But at the time, that was her medical diagnosis. That was the common term, mental retardation. And I didn't have a problem with that. It was interesting to me that he had a problem saying it. I thought that it was a very tender moment when he said that to me.
Yeah.
And I just never forgot it.
As you talk about Jennifer growing up and she starts going to school, and there's a time that she goes to mainstream, and then a time that she's pulled into what's usually called special education. What are your views on that? Because we hear people talk about we need to put people into mainstream so they can acclimate to general society, and yet there's something to be said about being with others who are like you and can identify with what you're facing.
That is an interesting question. In Jennifer's case, being mainstreamed was an excellent choice because, for one thing, she can speak. So she had, you know, speaking peers. She can read, so she had reading peers, and she's very social, and the other students loved her. But for just a brief moment in time, I worked as a paraprofessional with a girl who was profoundly disabled, and it was hard on the teacher in the classroom. I think it was fourth grade, and trying to integrate her into the classroom. I think the teacher really didn't like it. However, the other students were wonderful with that girl. So I believe personally in the least restrictive environment, which is what mainstreaming is. But it sort of depends on, I mean, I can also understand the other side where if a child is, you know, yelling or having outbursts or whatever, or violent, who knows, there's all sorts of disabilities, that could be disruptive in the classroom. I guess I feel like they should be mainstream as much as possible, and they need to have a paraprofessional with them, someone to kind of bridge the gap there.
Mm-hmm.
I know it was very good for Jennifer, and it was good for our community. Jennifer was about, I think, about 12 when they started mainstreaming students. You could see the effect on the community as well as the disabled students because the kindness factor went up and the understanding went up. I'm very proud of Clarkson and the way they've handled their disabled students.
I think in general, human nature has this fear of the unknown.
Yep.
And there's something to be said for getting to know something, whether it's a different race or a different ethnicity or a different physical ability or disability. Once you get to know someone, and that's part of that mainstreaming, I would think.
Yes.
You get more comfortable, and it's okay.
I didn't put it in the book, but Jennifer, of course, didn't get a typical high school diploma, but she got a certificate of completion when she was 26. And when she went on stage, she was in her cap and gown, and she went across the stage and turned to the audience and waved and blew kisses. And you'd have thought Ethel Merman was up there. I mean, the audience stood on their feet and clapped, and it was a wonderful, wonderful moment. And I think it really was an indicator of how mainstreaming was at its best.
And then there's this description of, like you said, 200 in the world with this syndrome. And at one point, you're at this gathering and you see other children who look like your child and other parents who are like you in the same situation facing some of the same challenges. How important is it to get together now and then with others?
Well, at the time, Jennifer was a teenager, I think, maybe 12 or 14, around in there, maybe 16. I wanted to go, and I wanted to learn what I could learn from the other parents and the doctors, because this was a conference for parents of children with Rubenstein syndrome. And there were doctors there who specialized in orthopedics and, you know, dentistry and that kind of thing. But it was a bizarre experience as well to walk into a room where everyone looked the same. It's similar to Down syndrome. Children with Down syndrome have common features. So do these children. And I put it in the book, but we stood and talked to a young woman who was Jennifer's twin. It was bizarre.
Was that comforting to you?
I wanted to hug that child. My maternal instincts came out. Yeah, it was a great. And Jennifer, that was the interesting thing. Jennifer took one look at her, and you could just see a light bulb go off inside of Jennifer's head, because we had never discussed the fact that she had a disability. She didn't ask about it, and she has very good self-confidence. And I just never occurred to me to talk to her as if she was different. And so looking at that other girl, I think she had an epiphany of some kind. But it was also disconcerting because a lot of the children were profoundly disabled. There was a lot that couldn't talk. There were many in wheelchairs. There were some with feeding tubes. And I felt sort of guilty, if that's the right word, you know, because Jennifer could do all those things. And it gives you perspective. You begin to realize that you're really quite lucky.
Someone can always be having a harder time than you.
Yep.
Yeah. And you also met Dr. Rubenstein.
I did. Well, he was somewhat elderly by the time I met him, but he was very nice. I had had a correspondence with him for quite a few years because he kept track of how Jennifer was developing and gave me advice when he could. And I had visions of him really wanting to meet us. Like, I really wanted to meet him. And he was very nice, but he wasn't as enthusiastic as I thought he would be, but it was nice to meet him. He and Dr. Taibbi are the ones who described the syndrome in 1963, I think.
Yeah.
And so it felt like I was in the presence of the final authority.
What would you want let's start with the medical people in this. What would you want them to understand that maybe they didn't?
I would like them to understand that the disabled are human beings. Dr. O'Neill was a wonderful, wonderful man, and we have a wonderful dentist, Dr. Spangler, who's in the book. But we encounter doctors who treated Jennifer like she was less than and, you know, didn't care if she lived, didn't want to treat her, you know, only saw her as her symptom. And so I would like the medical community to understand there's humanity there.
Yeah.
And have more compassion. But I've convinced myself, I think, that you can't teach people compassion. Of course, that wasn't all doctors. There were many wonderful doctors as well.
What about people, you know, outside of the medical profession? You talk about your community and how they embrace you. What is it that you would want people to understand, or when they read your book, what do you hope that they'll come away with?
Pretty much the same thing, that there's a human being there. Fortunately, we don't live in an era anymore where people look away as much as they did at one time in history. But just to realize that there's a human inside of that disabled body. And the interesting thing is, and I had a friend who had a brother with cerebral palsy, both of us agreed that there was a perfectly intelligent, normal person living inside that body.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, the person you have to connect with. And the thing that offends me the most is people who use the word retard publicly. I was in a bake shop one day and a woman used that word in front of me and I stopped her And she was about the fourth person. And I just decided I'm not going to tolerate it anymore as an epithet. You know, I just, but she didn't realize she was had said anything offensive, which I thought was very interesting. But that's how blasé we are about things like that.
Well, unless you encounter it personally, or unless you read a book like this. I think that that's a big part of your book, is getting the message out there.
I hope so.
And as we talk about that humanity and that we're all really the same, she goes through puberty. She goes through romance. You've got some love stories in here, which weren't always easy for you as a parent to handle.
No.
And they probably aren't for any of us.
No. No, they aren't. I had mixed feelings. I wanted her to have as many normal experiences as possible, but I didn't want her to have a sex life.
So it's that protection and wanting to let go.
Yep.
You seem to be constantly having to battle that.
She likes guys, too. She you do weigh and measure that kind of thing, because a pregnancy for her would be a devastating thing.
Also, isn't there a large chance that she could have a child just like her?
50%.
And
she could never care for a child.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
That's a problem.
But you did a great job in finding, well, it wasn't a group home. It was Claudia that she lived with. Talk about that process of you and your husband, and both of you in a little bit different ways, of letting go.
That was hard.
Because you have to think about someday you're going to be gone, and then who watches out for Jennifer.
That's right.
So talk about that.
Well, I had been the more involved parent in her medical care and her education. And the teachers, when she got to be about 26 and was ready to leave the educational system, because in Michigan you can go to school until you're 26 if you have a disability, they were pushing me to move her out of the house because it's a normal part of growing up. And I agreed with them, but I was afraid, and I was worried about where would we put her. And my husband and I looked at for 3 years before we found a place through the community mental health department that I thought was safe enough for her. And for my husband, he's a much more just a quiet person, you know, and he's not, he would have lived with her forever. But I don't think that's the healthiest way to go. And she has flourished since she moved out.
Has she? I was going to ask, how's she doing today?
Oh, she's doing great. She has a job in a workshop now. She lost her job at the cafeteria when they let people go.
Yeah, you wrote about that she works with silverware and cleaning it and how—
Best thing
again,
that ever
she
happened.
She puts her whole heart into it. I love that about her.
She used to wear one of those little hats that looks like a muffin, you know. It really wasn't so little. It was half as big as she was, but it was just adorable. And she used to pocket things. It was funny. But so she has a very good life. She lives she's in a different home now. But she has three other women about her age that live there. She has a wonderful couple that own it, and they're camping right now. She's having a great life.
Wonderful.
I don't think it was as hard for her to move out as it was for us to move her out.
Somehow I expected that.
Yeah. It was hard. I don't want to say it wasn't. It wasn't emotionally, you know, I think I sat down and cried afterwards, because it's very tough to let go.
I think it's tough for all of us. Any of us who have children have cried at that moment when it's goodbye and empty nest.
I brought my daughter over here to Western to go to school, and when I watched her walk away and cried then, my other daughter. So
your other daughter, Holly.
Yeah.
And you also have a son.
I have a son. Mm-hmm.
This isn't your only book, and I believe you're at work on one, too, about your son, or is that one already finished?
Well, I was at work on one about my son, but I've sort of stalled it. I don't think I'm going to finish that book. I don't think I'm going to finish it. I don't want to embarrass him, and he's at that age where it might be embarrassing. And he has a whole different complex set of issues. And
he has autism?
Yeah, he has what they used to call Asperger's. They now call it on the autism spectrum. But yes, and he's gay.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a particularly difficult combination because socially he doesn't get the social cues. And people make fun of him. He gets the terrible treatment that Jennifer didn't get, to be honest with you. He's had a very hard row to hoe.
Well, perhaps it's his story to write. And,
it may
and
be.
Someday
he
may want to tell it in his own way.
Yeah, he's a good writer.
We're talking about bullying and how you've got three children, how your children have been affected in different ways. Jennifer wasn't so much, perhaps because, as you were saying, that you could identify that she has a syndrome. Your son, not so much. What does bullying do to people? It's such a big problem today.
It's a terrible problem. And in my son's case, it was just so destructive. I had to change his school. But for 6 months, he came home and cried every night. And because he has Asperger's, he takes things literally. So if somebody says you're ugly, then you're ugly.
Yeah.
Or if somebody says you're stupid,
he buys into
then
that.
You're stupid. Yeah. His whole self-esteem is dictated, it seems to me, by people outside of himself. And that's been a hard lesson for me to tell him because he's a wonderful person. He's a wonderful person. But it was really bad. It started when he was about 12, when people it's interesting because he didn't know he was gay. Everybody else figured it out. And, of course, kids picked on him about that. They were terrible. It was terrible. It was a terrible, terrible time in his life. I had to take him to counseling. I had to change his school. And even then, he still encountered it. He still encounters it today.
And today he's 30 he's years
30
old?
He's 30 years old, but he's an eccentric kind of a person. It's sad that society doesn't have more tolerance for people who are different in other, you know, all sorts of ways.
Yeah.
Racially, ethnically, sexually, all of it.
And in inwardly ways, like you said, that we may not be able to see right away.
Right.
And, you know, you got to give people a chance.
There are a lot of people, I suspect. There's a lot of people with Asperger's or more severe forms of autism. But I suspect there's a lot of people walking around who have what I would call invisible disabilities, perhaps a mental illness, maybe epilepsy, who knows.
Or PTSD,
or
as
PTSD,
you mentioned.
Or PTSD. And it just seems like our society, I hate to bring that into it, but it just seems like the current state of our society is so angry and just no patience with anybody. And if you're different, you're afraid of you or afraid you're going to take something or you're going to get their job or whatever it is. And it's too bad because, in my opinion, diversity makes us a better place, not a lesser place. I mean, think of all the people. I mean, maybe there was a slave sometime in our history who could have cured cancer. Instead, he was a slave.
The talent and skills we've wasted.
All the things we lose because we can't see past our prejudices.
Yeah.
Yeah, I have an essay called Christian Becomes a Blur, and it's online on the Kresge Foundation's site. And it details how he dovetailed from a good student, a happy student, and with a lot of friends into a crisis based on bullying. It happened to come at puberty, so that made it hard. But that's what that's about. He was eventually diagnosed with OCD and ADD and Asperger's. He had, you know, a whole ream of diagnoses. He never really got over it. He's better, but he really never got over it. It's terrible. I cannot. And there's a lot of young people, gay people. There's straight people also. A lot of gay people are killing themselves over this kind of thing.
The suicide rate among gays is much higher.
I mean, I think my son sometimes thinks he's not a strong person, but I think he's a very strong person because he's still persevering in sight of that. And I don't think I'm overstating how things are for gay teens. I really don't.
How do you find balance, or do you find balance as a parent when you've got one or two children who demand more attention because they're facing more than the average challenges?
I dealt with it with guilt. I don't think I ever really found balance. It's sort of, with Jennifer, there was such urgency with her all the time, and my poor daughter, Holly, who is a gifted college professor at this point in her life. She just, I don't want to say she got shoved to the wayside, but I think it was hard for her. She didn't complain, but I sometimes look at the three of them and wonder if Holly actually didn't have it the hardest of anybody.
Because she got the least attention.
Yep, and she has said to me that she feels like the black sheep in the family because she's normal, which I think is a fascinating comment.
So maybe Holly needs to write a book, too.
Maybe.
It would be interesting to get her perspective of the family. That would be interesting. Anything you want to add as we tie this up that we haven't talked about?
Well, I hope people buy the book.
And where can they get it?
Well, it's available online through Amazon.com and Barnes & Noble. And I've been going around to independent bookstores in Michigan, and quite a few of them have taken it. I still have some more to hit. Best place to buy it is on Amazon.com. I mean, Amazon has taken over the world, but that's the best place to buy it probably, or Barnes & Noble.
All right. Well, thank you so much,
Carol.
Thank
you. Thank you for having me. It's really a pleasure.
And you're a wonderful writer, so keep writing, whether it's
part
two
or... Oh, I am. I'm working on a
book
about my mother, another interesting character.
That's another one. Yeah. All right. Well, thank you so much,
Carol.
Thank
you.